FilmWax Radio will be co-hosting an event at DCTV, which is in Lower Manhattan. It's on Lafayette, just south of Canal Street, on May 20th, Friday, May 20th, at 7 o'clock. I will be doing a live podcast interviewing D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus, you know, legendary filmmakers. They have a new documentary called Unlocking the Cage, which will be having a theatrical engagement at the Film Forum starting May 25th. That's the Wednesday following our event. So on Friday, though, what we're going to do is we're going to show clips, we'll show the trailer, we're going to have a great, fun conversation with the legendary team of Pennebaker and Hegedus, and then we will open it up to questions, and then we'll have a reception. It's going to be a load of fun, okay? DCTV is located at 87 Lafayette Street in New York City. You can check out their website, or you can go to their Facebook page or my Facebook page and get even more details. But essentially, that's the event. We'd love you to come down. It's a free event. We're opening it up to the public. Again, please come on down. Tell your friends. If you're in New York, come meet these legendary documentary filmmakers and learn about this great new documentary, which looks like it's going to have a great trajectory. So I'm very happy about that. And I'll talk more about it in the next couple of shows. But what I'm hoping is that this is the beginning of a series of live podcasts that I do with them through the summer. That's the plan, but we don't have that confirmed quite yet. But that is probably and likely what may be happening in the next weeks and months of the summer here in New York. So mark that on your calendars. Hey everybody, this is your host of FilmWax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff. Thank you for tuning in, streaming the show, downloading, whatever it is. I don't know, are you on iTunes? Hey, if you aren't, go to iTunes or Stitcher if you're on a Galaxy type of device or Android or something like that. We're on Stitcher. It's an app you can download for free. But you can also listen on iTunes, of course. But just subscribe to the podcast. That's the important thing. We want the podcast to get to you all the time. And this show is a wonderful episode we have coming up, by the way. What are we on here? Episode number 349 of the podcast. And I just snagged Whit Stillman. I kind of knew it was happening. I didn't want to mention it until it was in the can, though. Now, this is what happened. He's in L.A. I'm here, so I did it on the phone. He had kind of a crummy, as you'll hear, was jiving and kidding and teasing me about how, you know, it sounded like we were in some sort of, a swimming pool because I was outside. I couldn't make it. I just couldn't make it work to be in someplace private. I had other things going on, so I just sat on a park bench, and it was crazy. But so he said he would come back on. Now, as you know, I'm sure he was being very nice, and I think he meant it, but we'll see if it happens. But if we can all listen to the show and show our support, I'm sure. He said he would come into the studio. What? Studio? What are you talking about? Oh, I forgot to mention, didn't I? FilmWax Radio is now part of the Showbriz Studio podcast network. And what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean a terrible lot in terms of like the format of the show, but now what you're going to hear, I think, is even higher quality podcasts. So I'm going to be in the studio for a certain amount. Well, I'm going to say a lot more than I'm typically running around as I've been doing for a couple of years now. But now we have a studio. So we're going to have, I think, just a great leap in quality. And more people will come to the studio. And the studio's in Manhattan, so I think it's fairly central in that regard. So that's one thing. The other thing is now we're on with a bunch of other podcasters in this network of podcasts. And it is truly a terrific podcast network. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit as well. I want to just mention, though, that I'm pleased to be part of the Showbriz Studio Podcast Network. It is under the tutelage of Alex Brazell, who is the producer now. So we've got a real nice little operation now. So that's a big plus for the podcast. We'll, as I just said, we'll come back to that in a few minutes, and we'll talk a little bit later in the show about some of these other shows. Okay, so we have Whit Stillman, who is a seminal filmmaker. You know, he's part of this a group of filmmakers that was very important to my coming up in terms of my love of film, just at that time when I was beginning to really form my own opinions and tastes. And Whit Stillman, along with, I would say, Jim Jarmusch, Hal Hartley, Spike Lee, many other filmmakers, was right there with them. And I saw Metropolitan when it came out, and then I went back. I saw Barcelona, see Last Days of Disco, and then he took a long time off. Took a big period of time, like 13 years from movie making. I would love to get into that with him. I'm sure he's talked himself blue in the face about it, but at some point we got to get the guy back on the show and to talk about that. But then he also made, a couple of years ago, Damsels in Distress with Greta Gerwig, and now he's back with this brand new film. It's called Love and Friendship. And we'll talk a little bit about that movie also in just a minute before we bring on Wit. But I want to just tell you what else is happening on the show. We have a pair of podcasters from another movie podcast. This is not part of the network of podcasts. These guys are doing their own thing, but I've been in touch with them. They've advertised on the show before. So I wanted to mention that we'll be bringing on Dion Baia and Blake Fischera. They are two old friends who do a podcast called The Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. And it's them talking nostalgically about films from their past that they love. And they talk in great detail about them as if they were kind of hanging out, having a sleepover with their buddy and watching movies and talking about it. So it's a fun podcast. I go seek it out after you listen to the show if you're not already familiar with their podcast. And then finally, we have Dave Itzkoff on the show, who is a culture writer for the New York Times. He wrote a book that we're going to talk about on the Movie Network, which is having its 40th anniversary currently. So, but it's all about Paddy Chayefsky, who wrote the movie and the making of the film. It's available now in paperback. I wanted to bring him on, though, since we're having the anniversary, and I'm a fan of his writing. He's obviously a great journalist as well, and was a great guest. And that's the show. Love and Friendship was adapted from a novella by Jane Austen called Lady Susan. It's written and directed by Whit Stillman. It's an adaptation. That's why. It stars Kate Beckinsale, also appearances by Stephen Fry and Chloe Sevigny. And it is being distributed by Roadside Attractions. It is a very, very funny film. I can tell you right now, I really enjoy this as much as any other film I've seen of his, but just in general, it stands up as a wonderful period piece, but it's a comedy, and it is really made with a great amount of humor and energy. So I would say that Whit Stillman, back on top, back on top. There's also an accompanying book by Whit Stillman, that is the story here, even though it was adapted. He's calling it a ripoff or something like that, but it's his own book. It's also on sale. The book is called Love and Friendship, colon, in which Jane Austen's Lady Susan Vernon is entirely vindicated. It's available now in hardcover. You can buy it on Amazon or wherever books are sold, or download it. There's a Kindle version, in other words. So you have that book, and then there's a soundtrack coming out. So it's a multimedia experience. He's just coming on like gangbusters, this Whit Stillman fella. Anyway, the movie opens Friday, May 13th. And so it will be available to watch then. I urge you to go see this new Whit Stillman movie and to start a campaign, a grassroots campaign, to get Whit Stillman into the studio, into the Showbiz studio, to come back onto the podcast as soon as possible. So let's go into it right now, my conversation with Whit Stillman.
Does this woman always get her way?
She has an uncanny understanding of men's natures.
I can't help fear that Lady Susan Vernon would destroy every comfort of our lives.
With pleasure.
How ungentlemanly.
I'm enjoying Sir James's visit to Churchill.
Churchill? That's how you say it, all together like that. I'd heard church and hill, but couldn't find either. All I could see was this big house.
You promised that you would give up all contact with this woman.
What a mistake you made marrying him.
Too old to be governable, too young to die.
Lady Susan.
How dare you address me, sir? Be gone, or I will have you whipped.
Outrageous. Have you never met him?
No, I know him well. I would never speak to a stranger like that.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Whereabouts are you? What town are you in?
I'm in New York.
Okay, I've heard of it.
You've even been here on occasion.
I've been on there on occasion.
Do you remember?
Debutante parties.
Yes. And you'll be here in a few days, I understand.
Yeah.
Are you going to be here for the premiere of the film? Or?
Are they calling it a premiere? They're doing some... I've heard it referred to as a film event.
Oh, okay. That's not the way they used to describe it back in the day?
Well, they had the premiere here in Los Angeles, so I think they're calling it New York something different.
I see.
Do you see the pictures? There's been tons of pictures of the premiere.
Oh, okay. I will check them out. Well, I wasn't at the premiere, but I did have the pleasure of watching Love and Friendship at a press screening, or press and industry screening.
And no one died?
No, I don't. You heard about that one a few weeks ago?
Were you at that screening where the woman trips?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, man.
It was in the most remarkable screening because, you know, the Jane Austen Society was the present.
Oh, my gosh.
So a bunch of very nice, you know, middle-aged older women were there, very patient. And then also you had, I think, some people that may have known you. I don't know. It was very crowded. Yeah, this young lady walked down the aisle and took a fall. And I don't think she did anything more than maybe sprain her ankle, but you would have thought that she was meeting death. You know, I mean, it was very dramatic.
Was she a little bit histrionic?
I would leave out the little bit part. Maybe there's a role for her in your next project, though.
Yeah, I'm just really sorry to hear that that you guys can see the film at night. It just seems like it's a drag.
Well, it ultimately doesn't matter because I did see it. I was away for a little while. I was worried I may not get, you know, it may all fall through. I won't get a chance to see it ahead of time. But fortunately, I did see it. I really loved it a lot.
Even without people spraining ankles?
It sprained my heart. That's not a good... No, that doesn't make sense. It sprained my funny bone. That's better.
Good.
It really was funny, and the crowd was laughing out loud the whole time.
What's the story with this connection? I mean, is it my phone, or...
No.
I'm
sorry. The problem is I had to do this phone last minute, so I don't really have a good...
Well, here I just did. I found out I can raise the volume on my phone, so now it's fine.
Okay. I hope it helps a little. I apologize. It's just that it was like not really optimal. They just kind of told me yesterday, and I was hoping I might get you in person, and hopefully some point that will happen.
Yeah, but, I asked you why you couldn't, because I'm going to be in New York.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll still ask, and if you have a few minutes on Monday, I can make myself available. But
see, the problem is I don't get into town until Monday night because
I see.
Do stuff in Boston.
It's hard. Well, we could also do something else some other time. But when you're a little bit less crazed and there's a little bit of calm around it. One thing that occurred to me when I was watching Love and Friendship, and that is, as we all know, your language in your films, all of which I've seen, it's stylized and it kind of puts you back in time a lot. You feel like, you know, the characters are all from another time, almost a different period.
My college friends...
College
friends, I really hate it when people say people don't talk that way because we all talk just like that.
Are you still friends with them?
What?
Are you still friends with all those guys? Your friends from college?
Well, I see them. I mean, they're not all my friends, but they're a lot of my friends.
Okay. Because I was going to say, who cares? You know, I mean. But the point, I guess the larger point is that I felt like this, in a way, was the most contemporary feeling of all your films.
Yeah, that's true, probably.
Do you get? Have you been getting that?
No, but it's well put.
Yeah. Maybe it's in the approach, the way you frame the film. But the humor, I haven't read this short story. It's a novella, or is it a short story?
Novella.
It's a novella.
I think people would normally call it a novel, but it looks like a novella to me.
It's sort of like what you do with a 45-minute short film. What do you call it?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Maybe it's 55.
Right. Anyway, it's a literary work by an author. Let's put it that way. So when you were reading it, did you feel that way? Did you feel like, oh, this is I don't know, there's something about it which feels very contemporary?
Yes, I mean, not so much contemporary. When I read it, I felt this is Jane Austen channeling Oscar Wilde 80 years ahead of time. So it seemed very, you know, late 19th century foppish wit, immoral and a little devilish. And I think she felt that way too because she didn't want to publish it because I think it's a little too much, too frivolous and immoral for her later taste.
Were you hankering to make an adaptation from something like that for a while, or?
I'm not sure it's hankering exactly, but I was a little stymied with original stories, and most of the work I was doing in that period was adaptations. But they didn't see the light of day for one reason or another, because I had other companies involved. I think you have more chance to make your project if you don't sell your script. I think it's better, if you want to make a film, it's better you own the script.
What's involved in getting a Jane Austen script? I mean, I am assuming it's not public domain, but I could be wrong. I don't really even know.
What? Anything, anything published before 1900 is public domain.
Okay.
Unless it's a very long-lived author. And the main thing is the time after the death of an author. So I think it's Mickey Mouse.
Right.
It's forever extended, and now it's 75 years after the death of an author.
Okay.
But Mickey will always be under copyright this year. My plans to do a public domain Mickey Mouse film have been stymied.
I would like to see a Whit Stillman Mickey Mouse film.
Yes, I want to, the film I really want to make. It's good you have asked this question. The film I really want to make is the Uncle Scrooge story.
The duck.
Scrooge McDuck. Yeah, I want to do it, but not that silly DuckTales kind of thing. No, the real story. The real. I mean, I want to expose the Beagle Boys. I don't want to treat the Beagle Boys gently, the way they have been treated. The sort of Marxist interpretation of the Beagle Boys I reject completely.
Are you winding me up?
Kidding and seriousness go close together.
Yeah.
In the world of comedy writing.
Mm-hmm. You're now a comedy writer.
Are you in a swimming pool?
I know.
Are you?
Look, I don't know what to do about it because I honestly could not make. I had no space to work in, so I'm literally outside, sitting on a bench, and I can't.
Okay.
I don't know. Like I found a quiet space, and then about 5 or so minutes later, I just felt, oh, they're probably postponing. So I was going to try to find another. It's just everything was in retrograde as far as this went, so I apologize again. If it sounds awful, I'm going to...
Are you in a sopping wet bathing suit?
If it makes you feel better, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, if it fits your...
Do you want me to let you towel off for a while, or... Why it sounds like a swimming pool.
I know. I actually recently even... Like, I have a studio again. But I just couldn't get over there. I couldn't make this happen. So I thought, let me give this a shot, and
On to the next subject matter.
All right. Which is still the film, I suppose, because...
You know about the novel?
What's that?
You know about the novel?
The novel?
Yeah.
Love and Friendship?
Yeah, the Love and Friendship novel.
What about it?
You know it exists?
Yes, it does exist, and it's in bookstores, but are you pushing the novel, too?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Also the soundtrack.
Is it part of your mission to keep the kids... a lot of people aren't reading the classics anymore, I guess, unless they're majoring in literature.
I didn't major in literature. I majored in U.S. history since 1789.
So this is like a dream come true, then, doing this. And the film looks unbelievable.
Yeah, we had a pretty good experience.
I mean, I think the closest you came to making a period piece before this was probably Last Days of Disco.
I mean, in a way, Metropolitan was more of a period stretch.
Hmm.
Because, I mean, I couldn't do it that way. I just had to do that not so long ago, title card. But actually, I was making a film kind of set in the late 60s, and... I was shooting it in 88, 89.
You have to, because all the cars, everything has to be, all the signage.
Yeah, so I just had the sort of certain aspects of the story reflected that, and not the cars outside.
Where did you shoot the new film? Where was it shot?
The new film, I mean, it's really the backlot for many, many 18th century period films. Dublin was the second town of the British Empire in the 18th century, very prosperous. Mm-hmm. The implanted English aristocracy was there with a lot of money, and they built beautiful houses and beautiful squares and streets. And so it's kind of the Georgian studio backlot for British period films.
Gotcha. In the very, 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 very exceptional brief moments when I wasn't caught up in the story, I was really thinking, wow, he must have just been in heaven filming this.
Yeah, it's a very good experience. Now, Film Wax, is that your own deal, or is it something you work out with other people?
It's my own deal.
And how do you get it to be such a big deal? Like, how does it become so widely read?
Well, I appreciate your describing it as. Are you suggesting that Film Wax is a big deal?
Yeah, I assume it is because I'm talking to you from a phone in the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills, so I assume you're some big shot.
It's true. I wish I were. I should have.
The publicists are in awe of you.
It's mutual, but I've been working at it. You know, I met you in a bar like right when I started this thing, and
that's what everyone tells me.
Yep.
Everyone I talk to says I met you in a bar.
Yep.
When was that?
It was in a film. It was like some sort of film after a film party.
Was
and
I terribly drunk?
Not at all.
Okay.
Yes, you were.
It must have been early.
No. No, you were, in fact, you were with somebody, and I kind of, you know, sidled up as respectfully and cautiously as possible, and you said, get lost. No, you didn't say that, but you were
That's
very...
not true.
No, it's not. You were very nice, and I said, would you do this thing, and you actually gave me your email or something like that. I don't know. And so...
Do you have a radio show podcast kind of thing, too?
This is a podcast only now.
Are we being recorded as a podcast?
Yeah. Trust
me.
No.
Oh, man.
I know. Well, this is why I'm hoping to...
This is really weird.
Well, it's we'll see how it comes out. It may not be usable. It may be. I don't know. But I thought, let me give it a...
So if you need me to then come in and do something in the studio, maybe we should do that.
Yeah. I'll just say yes. Now...
Yes.
I also have portable equipment. I literally could come to anywhere you are...
I'm trying to understand this also. I don't have a space, and the swimming pools don't work out, so for sound.
Well, what should I do? What do you suggest?
Well, you have a studio, you said.
Yes.
Yeah, so I should come to a studio.
Absolutely, and there'll be...
Meanwhile, we're doing this now, and so, you know, anything to flog this film and the book and the soundtrack album.
Now, why was it that when I should have gone to the press screenings, there should have been copies of the book?
Well, it just came out. They just got it.
Oh, is it a new printing?
Well, see, this is the novel I wrote that has just come out. Little Brown just put it out. I'm publication day. It was due today.
Okay, this is the part that had been left out. That's why I'm just...
It's
wasn't...
The Love and Friendship novel. It's not the Lady Susan novel.
Oh.
We do include the text to Lady Susan within our book, so it's a two-for-one deal.
Well, no wonder you were bringing it up, and I didn't mean to try to...
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We have three products on the market now. We have the soundtrack album, we've got the movie in cinemas, only in cinemas, and then we have the...
The book, the novella.
The novel that yes. I did, the rip-off novel, which we have in three forms. We have it in hard copies, Kindle, or audiobooks with beautiful British accents.
Very good. And then the soundtrack.
Beautiful European music.
I'm going to plug all three then. All three of the of the products, as you put it.
I read Betker. Have you read Betker?
What?
Have you ever read Betker?
No.
Frank Betker, How I Raised Myself from Failure to Success in Sales.
I have not read that.
Do you want to sell your podcast, right?
Yeah.
You're a big audience.
Thank you. Is it?
Yeah, read Betker.
I will. I appreciate it. I mean, if you would just come on.
I've always thought of giving our firm sales agents that book, but I felt they'd take it badly.
I appreciate the heads up about it because I'm really not good at that. I go into meetings all the time, and I'm just the least comfortable bringing up the money. So I need somebody else. I think the first chapter should be about finding somebody to do it for you if you're not comfortable doing it.
Have you read Dale Carnegie?
Yes, I have read some Dale Carnegie. I was very curious about it, and you know, it's one of those you know ubiquitous works, so you have to know it. Yeah.
I'm glad you know that.
But I still haven't succeeded in getting more people to like me. But
well, that's not what it's about. It's really about selling.
I understand. So you're going through this very again, I guess, in terms of the public, you're in a more prolific stage. I even saw that there's another film down the line, possibly.
Well, it's kind of deceptive because you know, labors from many years finally come to market.
Sure.
And it's not as if you've been really well. much more prolific. But
I see.
We'll take that. We'll accept that. It's actually my first PG film.
Is that right?
Yep. I'm really proud.
Who even thinks about that? I never even thought about that.
Yeah, it's PG. They feel the kids can handle the reveal at the end. It's kind of biology class.
What would you...
So listen, this has been a good talk, but they're doing that thing where they're hands in a circle.
They're waving and gesticulating. Okay.
So I think we should try to redo this in a sound studio, because I'm not sure if your listeners will want the swimming pool effect.
There'll be champagne, Reed, Kava, waiting for you.
Very good.
No, it'll be champagne. I'll make sure.
Okay, thanks a lot for the talk.
Okay. Again, I reached out to David Itzkoff, who is one of the culture writers for the New York Times. I mean, this is a great guy who I've been reading for some time, and then I invited him onto the podcast, and it was a load of fun. We talk about this seminal 70s movie, which I touched on recently, not that long ago, actually, when I was talking to the documentary filmmaker Nancy Bersky. We were talking about her documentary by Sidney Lumet. Well, this is one of Sidney's films, and so there was a lot of convergence between these two conversations. In fact, I would urge you, if you haven't heard the conversation in episode number 346 with Nancy, to get that a listen. And then, you know, we touch on some of the things that I get into deeper with David Itzkoff about our conversation that you're going to hear right now about the movie Network, directed by Sidney Lumet, written by Patty Chayefsky, and starring, of course, William Holden, Peter Finch, Faye Dunaway, Ned Beatty, Robert Duvall, and so many other fine actors of the day. Let's go to my conversation with David Itzkoff.
When your day is long,
this is Adam Shartoff. Hey, this is our first official recording here in the studio, right, Alex? We're part of the Brazil Network here, and there's a lot of great shows. We'll get more into that shortly, but for now, I just want to bring on my first guest here in the studio, which is Dave Itzkoff. He's a culture writer for the New York Times. He wrote the book Mad as Hell, subtitle, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. You're not referring to the character there, of Peter Finch's character. You're referring to, I'm assuming, the writer of the film, correct?
Yeah, we were having a little bit of fun there in the title, a little sort of pun for people who are familiar with the movie, because, of course, your first instinct might be to think of Howard Beale, who's the angry, mad prophet of the airwaves, played by Finch. But we're talking specifically about Patty Chayefsky, who is the author of Network and its creative force, and the man who dreamed it up and got it made.
The book, again, Mad as Hell, and it's, I want to also add, it's published by Picador, is available now in paperback, and it's in 2016 is enjoying its 40th anniversary, so we just want to get that out of the way. So it's all the more, I think, very appropriate that we're doing this segment. And I'm sorry I didn't get to it sooner. I wish I had.
That's okay. Thank you for finding it now.
Yeah.
Anytime is fine, as long as you liked it.
I loved it, actually.
Great.
I really – you know, the book is – even though you'd think it's just a kind of a making of type of approach to the movie, the classic Network. In fact, what I found and was a nice surprise is it's kind of about Chayefsky. That's kind of the focus of this book. The backdrop is the making of the film.
Yes, I think, I mean, to understand.
Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to understand Network, you have to understand Patty Chayefsky. You have to understand not only his career and the trajectory that led him to the point where he wrote the movie, but also his way of thinking about the world and what he was so attuned to by the 1970s when he was in earnest writing the screenplay and doing the research for it, and why one a person like this in particular would turn out the movie that he did, because his career is, for as much success as he enjoyed, I mean, by the time he wrote Network, he'd already won 2 Academy Awards, and the screenplay for Network would be his 3rd. Mm-hmm. So a fairly powerful writer for his day and an acclaimed one. But also he was somebody who was very disenchanted with the world, had become very disenchanted with essentially every single medium that he had worked in to that point, which included
theater, yeah,
television, where he got his start,
right,
and movies, even as he continued to work in them, and was so sort of deeply afraid of, I think, so many developments that he saw in the nation and on a global scale. I mean, if all you know from the movie is the famous "mad as hell" speech that Peter Finch gives, I think you're still inclined to wonder, well, you know, what would make somebody write a speech like that for a character like that? What did you have to sort of be thinking about at the time, and to, you know, if you think of the sort of litany of social ills that Finch kind of runs down in that speech, I mean, Chayefsky was, in a sense, worried about every single one of them, that all those things were things that he saw as potentially, you know, devouring the country, making the world a worse place, and media itself being a kind of
conduit or something.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. A way to sort of mm-hmm. disseminate all of these woes.
Yeah, I mean, he came out of television. I mean, you could say he came out of theater too, or what have you, but certainly television was a central part of his early phase of his career. And he became a famous writer because of television. And then he was criticized after Network came out for himself criticizing television as a medium. But I think your point is actually that wasn't what he was trying to do. It was really saying something broader about society and about the commercialization and the corporatization of society. In that way, he was very prescient, of course. But it wasn't like he was a wholesale attacking television in particular.
No, I mean, that was certainly a huge aspect of the movie, but you're
sure,
right that it was, to him, it was a sort of larger meditation on, you know, alienation and, you know, people feeling, ironically, sort of more and more isolated even as media was moving faster and faster to connect them and make them aware of events happening in real time. Yeah. This is before, of course, the internet existed, before there was even really cable television to speak of. But yes, I mean, certainly it was received and interpreted as a large-scale attack on television, and surprisingly, that caught Chayefsky off guard.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Unless I'm mistaken, he refused to accept that the Network was satirizing television, right? He just rejected that, didn't he?
It sort of depends on, you know, what day of the week you talk to him kind of mood he was in. I mean, he's, you know, I mean, look, he was a wonderfully sort of disgruntled, dyspeptic figure, and that, you know, made him a fantastic writer. And, I you know, I'm sure in his heart of hearts somewhere, and we can't know for certain, but my guess is that, yes, I mean, he understood that part of what he was doing was, you know, biting the hand that once fed him. And you know, if people don't know that, you know, his big breakthrough was writing a lot of the sort of early, you know, golden age of television dramas, the sort of standalone dramas that would play on the anthology shows, and most famously Marty, which became the motion picture for which he also won the screenplay, wrote the screenplay and won his first Oscar. So there was, on the one hand, this feeling, you know, to people who knew him, this sense of, well, you know, how could you burn that bridge and turn your back on that medium. But also in the course of researching and writing Network, he had been able to spend time at the news operations of the 3 broadcast networks of the day, and you know, he hung out with Walter Cronkite and John Chancellor.
Hired Cronkite's daughter.
Exactly.
Cast, right? Well, or I should say Sidney Lumet was, and the casting director.
But right, certainly Chayefsky had a say in that as well. I mean, he was he got, you know, final say over everything in the
right.
film.
So, glad you brought that up, actually, because Chayefsky had an unprecedented role, and I don't know if this existed before him. It must have, but that he had final say, like, nobody could change a word or dialogue. In fact, it was Cronkite's daughter. Remind me of her first name.
Kathy Cronkite.
Kathy Cronkite, yeah. Who plays a role in the film Network, loosely based on Patty Hearst, and which is a subplot going on in the film. And she approached Chayefsky very politely and charmingly about maybe changing a couple of words here and there so it would be more comfortable for her. And in a more generous moment, said, you know, how, you know, let's go with the dialogue I wrote. And, you know, whereas I'm sure in other situations, he would have been far less patient.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Kathy recognized, I mean, she was so green in her career at that point. Only somebody that sort of, you know, earnest and naive could get away with an opportunity or a moment like that. But it existed because, you know, Chayefsky had essentially, you know, I mean, he sort of amassed his own, you know, power and influence to that point to get himself into a situation where he could literally be, you know, be on set every single day and not just sort of hanging around or right. waiting for somebody to ask him about the script, but that he had a special physical place, you know, where they would film. He would be standing aside, you know, just a couple of feet off from the camera underneath his own little light so that he could see what was going on. And that's where he watched every take of the film. And he wasn't necessarily watching to, you know, he was not going to give notes to the actors on how they should adjust their performances.
No, he never crossed the line. He knew his place as far as – and Sidney Lumet's place, in fact. The two got along pretty well, didn't they?
Absolutely. And Lumet, you know, knew what he was signing on for as well and understood
right.
that this – if he was going to take this particular gig, that it would be, if not, you know, a collaboration, then in some ways he was going to be, you know, subordinate to Chayefsky. And if – I mean, if you recall even the credits of the movie, you can go back and look at this. It doesn't – you know, the first title comes up and it says Network. And it doesn't say screenplay by Paddy Chayefsky. It says by Paddy Chayefsky.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the kind of thing that now if a director might get that kind of a credit because they would have that much influence over a film. But that's the level of control that he had and the degree to which this was really understood to be emanating from him. Even Lumet, for as much as he puts his fingerprints on the film and you really see his style and dynamic in it and he's – you know, clearly exerting a lot of blood and toil. It's really Chayefsky's movie.
You're absolutely right. I don't even think there's been a case, with maybe the exception of Neil Simon, of anybody who's had their name above a film title. I'm sure, again, I'm not right, but I don't recall, and I have a pretty good, you know, grasp. I mean, in terms of a writer of a screenplay having their name in the place of the director.
Yeah,
I think Neil Simon is maybe the only other exception. And, you know, his... argue what you will, but Paddy Chayefsky certainly broke the mold. I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also a funny thing that, you know, of course, you know, Network came out in 76, and so sort of you know, if you believe in sort of the auteur, you know.
Sorry, William Shakespeare. Excuse
right.
me. Continue. Go ahead.
Yeah, he never directed any films, though. Yeah.
But his name occasionally does get above the title. I just remembered.
Yeah,
just ignore what I was saying. I was showboating.
You know, this was a sort of, you know, this is the height of the auteur filmmaking movement. And really neither Chayefsky nor Lumet came out of that movement. They were both guys from the previous generation and were guys who had cut their teeth in live TV. And so the fact that they end up, both of them, you know, being the sort of key contributors to this movie from, you know, that also is sort of part of that auteur era is sort of, you know, it's kind of accidental.
We're talking to Dave Itzkoff. He's a culture writer for The New York Times. I'm not saying the culture writer because –
There are others, many others.
There are many others. But you are somebody whose name has come up in my purview many times, actually. So it's a pleasure. And we're discussing his book, Mad as Hell. It's available now where books are sold or – streamed? I don't know. There is, I would imagine, a Kindle copy or what have you.
Absolutely.
An e-book as well. And again, Network, which I just recently watched again. And I wanted to mention something about my having, because I remember this coming out when I was a very, 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 very little kid. But it was so much in the zeitgeist. I mean, there's no exaggeration to say that everybody referenced, it was like one of the catchphrases, like, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat. On and on. I mean, through.
Sure.
But Mad as Hell, that was the sort of the most popular scene that people that still resonates. But as I was watching, actually, there was another scene that to me is, in fact, the big I think I don't know what you call it, maybe the apex or the
denouement.
And that's the scene with Ned Beatty.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. I think really that, in a sense, is cumulatively most dramatic scene in the whole film.
Yeah. And it's I don't know if it's funny or ironic that also another great speech, fantastically delivered and beautifully shot. It does get a little overshadowed in a sense by the Mad as Hell speech, which kind of occurs, you know, right sort of dead center in the film. And that's a real sort of, you know, you can easily divide the film into everything that happens before the Mad as Hell speech, everything that happens after. Beatty, I mean, it gives just as memorable a delivery, and that's the speech where he is the head of the corporation that owns the network that Howard Beale is on, and as Beale is sort of, on the one hand, descending further into his madness, but also becoming ever more influential as a broadcaster, that is when Beatty's character sort of pulls him aside into his boardroom and says, look, you know, you think that the world is nations? There are no nations. There are corporations, and there's only dollars and shekels and rubles, and it forever sort of changes Beale's way of looking at the world, and he becomes a kind of corrupted character after that. And it is extremely valid today, that speech, as much as the Mad as Hell speech. This idea that on a simple level, that you know, corporations can have much more influence than nations, but also just the influence of, not to sound like a wide-eyed conspiracy theorist, but the influence everywhere of corporate money and the influence of corporations being able to tell you what you can and can't say, that certainly grown in the 40 years since this film came out.
The film, holds up entirely. If you haven't seen Network before, or if it's been a long time, I really urge everybody to go catch it again. And it stars, you know, aside from Peter Finch, who we've already mentioned, and we've mentioned, Ned Beatty, who is a very actually small role in it, but very important role. Faye Dunaway, of course, and William Holden and Robert Duvall. What a cast! Written by Patty Chayefsky, directed by Sidney Lumet. It's just an incredible team. Actually, another day player, Ned Beatty, by the way, was nominated for an Oscar for just a few moments on the screen, as was the actress
Beatrice Straight.
Thank you, yeah. Beatrice Straight, who was another stage, came from the stage, and she actually won the Oscar.
That's right.
She played Holden's wife, and she was also only in for a few minutes, but had an incredible performance. Just really, just very moving, and is very powerful. Peter Finch died after he was nominated, but before he was able to, before the awards.
That's right.
Right.
I mean, he basically died, you know, yeah, in the course of promoting the film for its sort of award season. You know, I mean, this is an era before there really was, this kind of full scale, Oscar campaigning that we're used to now.
Oh, my God, right.
But it was, a Network was a late, a year end release. It came out, the widest national release was sort of November of 76, so Oscar nominations would have been right around the corner. Mm-hmm. And, people like like Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall and even Bill Holden, I mean, they had moved on to other projects by the time it came time to, they were just working on other things. So the few people they could really tap to, sort of pound the drum in the press were Chayefsky himself, who, as we talked about, was sort of very dyspeptic and disgruntled and could go on the air and rant
Never
about
– yeah. You couldn't really guarantee what he was going to be like.
Right. May or may not have been the best
caveat
guy.
Emptor.
Exactly. Yeah. So that a lot of that burden also fell on Peter Finch. And
sure.
He'd been out of the limelight for a really long time when this role came along. And, as he saw it sort of gaining steam, he'd been living in Jamaica and moved back to Beverly Hills to sort of, take advantage of this opportunity and kind of bask in all the goodwill that the role was generating. And yes, he died of a heart attack waiting. He and Sidney Lumet were about to do a remote appearance for one of the Network morning shows, and he died in the hotel lobby.
Practically in Lumet's arms, right?
Yeah, well, Lumet was one of the first people on the scene and tried to revive him, yeah.
Yeah. Also, William Holden died not long after.
Yeah, right? within a couple of years after making the film. I mean, he sort of – this was one of his – last great roles as well, and he was also a nominee. And I mean, of course, you know, I mean, he was not going to win out over, you know, Peter Finch, but, I mean, certainly gives, you know, as stellar a performance in his own right.
The movie came out in 1976. It was ran up against just a couple of other relatively popular films. I think it shared Beatrice Straight, of course, won for Best Supporting Actress. We already said Peter Finch won for Best Actor.
That's correct.
And there were Chayefsky won, of course, for Best Screenplay.
And Dunaway for Best Actress.
Oh, like, she writes, right. That, yeah. Goodness gracious. Split the awards, though. I'd say the rest kind of went to either Rocky. Rocky won.
For Best Picture.
Okay.
And John Avildsen won for best Director.
Direction. Okay,
and
very
I think that, you know, I mean, Rocky has a lot of merits as well. But I think that kind of sticks in people's craws to some degree that you know, this was as good a year as any for Lumet to have won Best Director. And, you know, I mean, Rocky, God bless it. But, you know, it is, you know, it's become the sort of, if it wasn't already, the sort of archetypical, mm-hmm. you know, underdog sports film blueprint. Whereas, you know, Network maybe saying a few more complicated things and maybe teaching some lessons that have resonated a little bit longer.
So you didn't go for the Rocky. Well, now that you brought it up, actually, since I'm going to guess, I don't know, you were maybe not even alive 4 years ago.
This was the year of my birth, so that's why it has a – there's a lot of reasons why it resonates for me and why it's a special film for me. But I suspect that has some – just anytime I hear the year 1976, it just kind of dings a bell for
me. Sure. Well, so. Why wouldn't it? Same here. Yeah. Mine is just 77 or 78. I won't divulge. no, a little before, actually. So something went ding, but what was the ultimate draw? You had a fascination with that period as well. 70s, of course, is told to a lot of resonance for film lovers.
Sure. I mean, it's all the things that you mentioned. Right. I mean, it's a movie set in New York. It's, you know, a sort of a rare, maybe the only sort of era of this kind of, you know, polemical filmmaking where, you know, this is a movie that was financed by two studios, by MGM and United Artists, that was basically, you know, telling its audience how bad the mass media is and for, you know, the big media corporations to basically be, you know, funding that and giving it a platform to exist is astounding. That could never happen. Today, so all those things, but just Chayefsky as a personality, as a figure, is just irresistible. And I had this extraordinary opportunity because all of his papers are owned by the New York Public Library's Library for the Performing Arts, mm-hmm. and they're accessible to, you know, anybody who wants to request them. So you know, they allowed me first for an article for the Times that I wrote, and then for the book, I just, you know, got to see, you know, as many of his papers as I could relating to the making of this film and to really the, you know, the breadth of his career. And it's sort of an obvious thing to say, but, you know, again, it's an era before there was no digital technology to speak of. He didn't work on computer. Everything was either typewritten or handwritten. And because he was so fastidious and a little bit neurotic about fears of being sued, which he was eventually sued for his work, he just kept everything. And so mm-hmm. you really can see, I mean, just by reading the papers, you can see the full trajectory of the film's creation, all the different iterations that it went through and all the ways that he thought about it because he was so disciplined about just committing everything to paper.
Mad as Hell. It's the name of the book. The author, Dave Itzkoff, of the New York Times. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Really pleasure meeting you. Thanks a lot. And again, last up, here is Dion and Blake regarding their very singular podcast, which you can find on iTunes, on Stitcher, and a bunch of other podcast apps and other podcast apps. And again, it's called Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. Here's Blake and Dion.
Do you remember a time when sleeping on the floor with your friends wouldn't have been considered weird? The management of this website invites you to a new dimension in podcasting. An experience so fun, it can only be compared to a childhood sleepover. It's not just about horror.
Tom Atkins proves that any man is leading man material.
It's not just about action.
If you're going to rank Van Damme movies,
yeah, it's up there.
I'd put it top five.
It's not just about comedy.
There's no other person in the world that loves Weekend at Bernie's more than you.
It's not just about science fiction.
And you scrim with, like, a beautiful comb over.
It's about nostalgia. Can you survive the Saturday night movie sleepover? It's not a movie. It's a podcast about movies.
You can follow Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at SaturdaySleepovers.podwits.com. That's SaturdaySleepovers.podwits.com. On Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher.
This is only like the second time. I mean, I guess technically it's the third time that I'm working out of the Showbiz studios with my new producer, Alex Brazel. Thank you, Alex, first of all.
You're here. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful studio as well.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
it's really nice.
Lovely.
And there's been a lot of cool people in this room here, not just for my podcast. I'm saying there's about five other podcasts on this network. So,
oh, wow.
And we're six. It just happened. Seven.
It's almost the
eight. Eight. It's like he's giving birth. Wait a minute. It's an what is it? You have octopuses? I don't know. It's the runt of the litter. Is it me? Unfortunately, but anyway, one more auspicious way to get one of the first programs off, but by interviewing another movie podcast. So, thank you, Blake.
Yes,
Blake Fischera. Right?
Yes.
And Dion Baia.
Oh, well, I got on the first time. That's good. That's really
good.
Well,
I did have a conversation with you. Yeah. But I noticed when we were doing so much back and forth corresponding in the last couple of days that, you know, I finally really took a closer look and I said, hey, that's an I, not an L.
Yeah.
But I know you have a tricky schedule, so thanks for...
No, thank you for accommodating as well.
Yeah. I'm not even sure how your podcast, which, by the way, let's get this out of the way. Don't bury the lead, as they say. It's called Saturday Night Movie Sleepover, right?
Correct.
Or is it movies plural?
Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers.
Oh, sleepovers is
plural. Sleepovers. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's okay. Like it's clutch that we're bringing the experience of the old fashioned nostalgic retro sleepover. You know, everybody growing up.
Oh, sure. You go over to your buddies. They're sleeping over each other's was something we grew up doing because I don't even know if you told your parents about it because they were the last to know. But you'd go over to your buddy's place down the block or wherever, or maybe in another apartment unit, and you'd like go to, well, if it's a house, you go down to the basement or wherever you're going to crash,
they
or in their bedroom,
you.
And you sleep over, you're watching movies. Now, this maybe for you guys lasted a little longer because it sounds like these movies were not all kid movies.
No, I mean, I think it, for myself, I was kind of, my parents, my father certainly, I was shown a lot of movies at a young age. Uh-huh. So I guess we turned out all right. So
Adam. we have three voices all in the kind of the same range. I struggle when I listen to your podcast, by the way, to remember who's who because you guys, your voices are kind of roughly in the same register. You know, you have different personalities.
Go up an octave.
Start talking like this.
Yeah. I go real low.
I also was introduced to movies that were way too mature for me early on, but there wasn't a catalog of Disney and Pixar and all this stuff.
Do you find it now, though, being the age we are, that you have an issue with that? Like now, I think about it. If I were to have children, I'd be like, "Would I show them the same things I watched when I was little?"
No, you know? Because they're watching porn on YouTube.
There you go. Exactly.
So
the
bar is so different. You know, it's at a different.
You don't, there's and no I'm more seeking it out around. At your brother's. You know, finding your brother's Playboy or finding your dad's. But now it's just like Google.
No,
the worst thing you've ever seen.
No, I have a very young child. And it was just brought to my attention that he discovered I gave him a smartphone finally.
You didn't limit it? You didn't put like parent restrictions
on it? I have to figure
it?
Out how to do all this. I got to go back to the Sprint store.
See,
or
they're
something.
Smarter than you. They know like that. Dad won't get that at first.
Well, he does the stop motion stuff.
Oh.
You know, there's an app and he will shoot all this stop motion stuff. He's very proud of it with his Legos. And he's good.
Yeah.
So I'm encouraging it. And then he uploads it to – I created a YouTube channel for him. And in that recreation, I believe we put in his age, but maybe I didn't because then it would probably automatically – I don't know.
I'm getting off on a tangent.
I'm looking
true,
now
but
for
But it's
him.
Kind of just it's a whole different world.
Style. Yeah,
it's a different
do.
World. I don't want his nostalgia getting back to your podcast. Again, it's called Saturday Night Sleepover, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. I don't want, you know, his version of that. Like, hey, my podcast is those, you know, lesbian porn videos that I accidentally watched on YouTube.
Imagine somebody had a podcast where they just critiqued.
Well, that wasn't very good as opposed
I'm
to.
I'm sure there is one.
There must be. There, I'm sure.
I have an affinity for 70s porn because I like that there was production value.
Sure.
There were session bands that was what they did. They would go in and do sessions where they would just do soundtracks for pornos, which is amazing to me now.
Well, that's when we'll do Deep Throat one of these days.
Yeah, or Behind the Green Door. The ones that were actually theatrically released, like the avant-garde. Like,
there were lots. But those movies, by the way, would run for months, maybe years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of them, I think, maybe Beyond the Green Door, and I think
Still
Deep Throat were at Cannes. They played at Cannes.
Yeah.
You know, and there was the big thing, like, right. Jack. That's why, if you
it
remember...
It was very Vogue for a while.
The movie Taxi Driver, I had, like, when De Niro takes, Cybill Shepherd to go see the movie, I think that's what he thinks, because of the era, you think about people who are going to see these movies.
Yeah.
He thinks, oh, maybe I'll take her to see this when it's in actuality. Well, it's like, hey, he's taking a porno.
Yeah, I'm going to actually... Going by Travis Bickle's
psyche.
Intentions and his psyche, right, his psyche is not exactly, I don't know if that was, I think actually, I do think he was trying to do something on some level innocent, but it was.
It wasn't as innocuous.
No, but those are the movies he was going to because of some psychotic reason.
Good point.
In the first place. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, there are plenty of other films coming out around that time.
But we digress, as we always do.
We do. You're right, they were part of the mainstream. The films you guys talk about, though, are... Mostly since they're from your childhood, right? For the most part, I'm generalizing. That they're mostly those 80s into the 90s, would you say? I don't want to, again, I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to create an idea for people to grab onto.
We've been doing a healthy catalog back into the 70s because I think a lot of stuff that we would view would be something that was shown to us. But then I think the earliest we've gone is we've done Peter Lorre's Mad Love, which is 1933.
Oh, I remember that episode, in fact.
Yeah,
that's one of my
favorite
episodes.
We tried to go down the alley, as we call it.
Yeah.
And then so we try to give, but we usually hang within the 80s, early 90s.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the 80s, late 80s into early 90s is like when we were kind of the prime age for having sleepovers with your friends.
And those
watch
are in
movies.
They're in your fiber, in a sense, because, of course, you were developing your personality.
And we kind of started with that, and then the response was really big in terms of people that listened, and we had a lot of people that would message us on Facebook, and it seemed like they were our age. So those are the ones that we tend to...
people with kids that are like, geez, I haven't thought of this movie in 20 or 30 years, or I'm so glad that someone as likes this, or...
People responding, in other words, when you would tap into the Ghostbusters, the Gremlins, the Breakfast Clubs, the what have you, all those...
Yeah, or, you know, sometimes it's like...
Like Smokey and the Bandit, Dick Tracy.
Right.
We did 1990s Dick Tracy, and that was like
we dropped
a huge response.
Yeah. Really,
unbelievable. You know,
so you kind of get an idea of your demographic by nobody goes on. Nobody contacts me on Facebook.
But you know, the thing with us is we get worried. I mean, sometimes we don't want to 100% curtail to the audience and do something we don't like. But at the same time, sometimes we'll throw something out like we did. The Night Stalker, Darren McGavin. So we're like, we don't know if this is going to hit, but because it's X-Files is coming out, and Chris Carter directly references the Night Stalker as
a direct through line.
So we were thinking of doing a movie of the week, a TV movie. So like, what better movie to do than Richard Matheson's Night Stalker with Darren McGavin? So sometimes we don't know how they're going to hit, and sometimes we think they're going to do better than they do, or other times we don't think they're going
to
do very well, and then they do gangbusters.
Hard
and we're like,
predict.
Huh?
Well, I always put and make the when we do a TV movie, it's like, well, before home video. Like a Saturday night or Sunday night movie was probably the only movie nights the movie sleepover you could have.
Yeah, you know, before VHS, people had accessibility or even I guess syndication on television. Yeah. People forget.
Well, they had the movie of the week.
Yeah,
that type of thing.
Yeah,
and there was afternoon movie. You just watched what they put in front of you.
Yeah, and that's how a lot of stuff. I think a lot of times,
certainly Night Stalker would fall under that.
You know, like a lot of movies that went into public domain that are now classics. Say like It's a Wonderful Life. It was only because it was just. The crap out of being circulated on television and you'd see it every year or whatever. Like even most recently, A Christmas Story. It's like, I think it's just because somebody got the rights and they played it, 25 hours a day for eight days a week. And then it's like, that's why it becomes a classic, So
what's the, So you do the show every other week? I forget.
Yeah, yeah, bi-weekly.
Generally, right?
Yeah, unless two or two a month. And then we sometimes will put a special episode in, you know. Right. But it's also because of our schedules. I mean, we work, you know, 40-hour weeks, so sometimes
to get together for a sleepover.
Yeah, we have a lot of... Yeah, yeah.
Do you do it overnight?
Yeah, well, sometimes, you know, we have to go over to our parents' house, and we'll and they're like, Jesus, you're still coming over. You're almost 40.
Is that the idea, that you do it there because you're trying to get into that...
That's the goal, to present.
As it would be.
The authentic...
And we usually go into, like, some sort of reminiscing at the beginning. We talk about, like, you know, furnished basements or anything that you can remember. You know, pizzas, Mega Joe Colas, whatever you can remember. Mm-hmm. You know, boobs, looking at, like, you know, rent a movie just for the boobs. You know,
yeah,
like, you know, so,
sure.
And then that kind of segues us into the movies.
Has that stopped?
For people, no. I think they're Googling porn now. They don't need to go.
Oh, got Mr. Skin. So you know? Don't need to rent the
That's
movie.
That's right.
Yeah, you don't need to go. You can just, it's accessible by your son's phone, which sadly, you know, people.
Yeah. For those who don't know Mr. Skin, you can listen to the Gilbert Gottfried podcast. I think they had him on recently. He's the one that has, you know, put together a website of just clips of naked women.
I don't know Mr. Skin. You know, you both know Mr. Skin.
Oh, you got to know about this.
Yeah.
It's a website where, you know, he has over the years, you know, right, gotten figured out where
it's like it's movies that have been released. So it's not like, you know, sex tapes or paparazzi.
No, it's all
it takes actual movies and then they like narrow like down theatrical the sex scene.
Oh, so
like
you
could have seen a nipple, like Nicole Kidman's nipple. You know,
I know that site.
At 45 minutes into whatever movie.
And he clocks it for you so you know. If you get to see, like, the Daryl Hannah, like, you see breasts and whatever, he'll tell you what frame.
He'll tell you, like, what, exactly.
What scene, how much, you know, 35:20 into the movie, you're going to see some titties.
That's right. Yeah.
Excuse my language.
No. Okay, so you do this every other week, and you choose a different movie each time, and each episode runs a couple of hours, right? Sometimes.
They become epics,
well,
which is funny.
You don't have like a – you just talk
– No, we don't try to put a parameter on it. I mean, we do want to restrict. Sometimes we think like if we're getting really long and we're like, Jesus, who's going to hell listen to us? But then we go by the idea that sometimes in this day and age, people will turn stuff off and listen.
They can come back
commuting.
To it.
Yeah, so – I mean, we've gone as short as an hour to, like, geez, we did the 1989 Tim Burton's Batman, and that was, like, our epic over 2.5 hours. We still had stuff.
It was, like, 3 hours. But we've done – they're getting longer. I'm not exactly sure how I feel about it. Yeah. But it's hard to
– But it's not on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to – the worry is if we think about it while we're doing it, then it – you know, it'll take something away from the show.
Yeah, we don't want to shortchange
it. If we're, like, watching the clock.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We just go and
sometimes we usually know how long something will, you know, we have a time frame of how long we have the window of recording for us for the sleepover versus, you know, afterward of actually what's going to accomplish, put it to acid tape or to wax.
What you don't know each time.
It's what you know what you don't know.
Well, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
Right. But
Donald Rumsfeld over here.
That's right. But there is an organic nature to every conversation. I mean, I know that that's my experience doing a podcast, and obviously that's everybody's. So you don't know when you're going to hit your stride. It could be at the beginning of your podcast, but it could also be 40 minutes in. All of a sudden you start hitting a stride in the conversation, and you want to let that ride out because you're enjoying it, first of all, but you also know it's good talk. It's good. You know, it's going to be a good experience for the listener. So, you know, if it starts at 40 minutes in as opposed to at the beginning, you might be going for another hour. You know, you never know. And some films, you don't even can anticipate which ones are going to ignite the conversation. That's where you're going to get you know, you don't anticipate, oh, wow, you know,
and we
really got into the
nitty. We've known each other for, almost 20 years now. So I think what happens with us, I don't think it's a bad thing, but we end up BSing for the first, or reminiscing, like we say. Then it's like we'll be 40 minutes in. We're like, gosh, we haven't even got to the movie yet. You know, we have to, you know, transition and, you know, get to what we're talking about.
Well, like we did.
I mean, it's always related. We're not like, hey, what did you
like
yesterday?
Well, we tend to, like, the format of the show for the, you know, for people that haven't listened yet is, obviously, we kind of mentioned that we talk about one movie. But we also, we talk about the viewing experience, us watching it this time. We talk about, we reminisce and our nostalgia either about the time that it came out or the movie itself when we first saw it. We'll sometimes talk about that kind of stuff. And if it's like we did No Holds Barred, classic wrestling.
Yeah. Which one's that?
It's a movie with Hulk Hogan. It was like the first one that like WWE.
Tiny Lister, AKA, what's his name? He's from the Friday movies. And he had a big.
He was recognizable. Yeah. He's a very distinctive look.
Debo from the Friday movies.
But so we kind of did it as like WrestleMania is going to be coming up, so let's do a WrestleMania.
And it bombed when it came out. You know,
the movie
did. Yeah, not WrestleMania, and it's not regarded very well. But I think another thing with our podcast, we don't really try to poop on the movies. We don't really want to. You know, a lot of people, that's their shtick when they'll take a movie and they'll just try and say, wow, this is so stupid. And it's like, well, we come into it saying, you know what, we understand the issues. We try to unpack it and we say, you know, we understand what the limitations were. Yeah. We're completely, you know, open to that. But we try to praise what we find, you know, positives, if there are anything. And then we try to then bring in the psychology of us seeing it at that age, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking.
Yeah. Well, that podcast was a lot about, in the beginning, was a lot about, specifically that one was about how big wrestling was.
Yeah, in the late 80s.
When we were growing up.
It came out in 89, and we tried to set the table for people who don't know, who are younger, who that, you know, coming in from the late 70s into the 80s, wrestling was, and they had a cartoon show. So we tried to, that's a lot of things we tried to do. I wouldn't call it education, but a lot of our movies we bring in.
We do a lot of research.
Yeah, so we talk about the movie. So it's not just us. How did you feel with the movie? Well, how did you feel? It's also like, well, this is what happened, and we'll set up the era it came out, and we have a fun thing. We give some context. Yeah, we have a thing called the What If Game, where we'll talk about who would have been in the role that they cast, and then it didn't work out or whatever.
Other people that might were up for the role, you know.
Oh, I see.
You
know, were actually up for the role.
Yeah, okay. And then it didn't work out or whatever reason, you know, and then. Whatever. So we try to bring a lot of that. We try to bring like some sort of intelligence into it to try to like just educate. Yeah. So it's not just
like
us
Pam Grier was originally up for that role, and Hulk Hogan ended up.
Yeah, exactly. Who would have known? You know.
We'll also talk about the making of the movie and other
issues that happened and all that kind of. It's just basically it's like special features
for real movie fans, especially from your childhood maybe experiences. This is a great podcast for you then. You know. And now you obviously have to watch the movie over and over or a couple more times again because maybe there might be a period where like you haven't seen the movie in a long time.
Well, that's fun.
Right. So leading up to the podcast, you might need to see it a couple more times just to refresh and all that as you're doing research. And I'm wondering if when you see it over again, if you have such a different experience to it that you sometimes maybe realize, this isn't the right thing.
Right for the show.
Well, I don't know. Like, you might nostalgically have loved...
You remember it so much being better, than you watch it, and then it's
pretty young. I was already a young... No, maybe still been a late teenager. I saw Stuntman, you know?
Of course, yeah.
Richard
Rush.
Great movie.
Great
class. I couldn't believe when I walked out of that movie.
You wanted to go jump off
a theater.
Roof. Yeah.
For all the best reasons.
Did somebody die in making that movie? I think maybe somebody was killed.
I'm not sure.
There was a span of those late 70s, early 80s Stuntman movies that somebody actually was killed. Doing it.
Oh,
like, whoa, we got
a. There were a few. I guess, most notoriously The Twilight Zone.
And Vic Morrow.
Yeah.
Which we bring up a lot for some reason on our podcast.
It's a hot topic for us, unfortunately.
Well, I don't remember somebody. It's possible, or it was just. Anyway, but the whole Stuntman, I walked out of there feeling like this is like the greatest movie I've ever seen. It's just incredible. This is when it came out.
Of course, yeah.
Now, flash forward years later, like about 10 years ago, and I'm kind of just saying, I'm going to buy a DVD today. I just had that impulse, and I went into shop, and I found the Stuntman, and I said, holy crap. I'm like so happy. I said, I'm going to get this, and I want a
copy. Cover the DVD had, too. I mean, the cover art was very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
I could imagine picking it up.
What's the cover? I don't remember the cover.
It's like a
drawing. Barbara Hershey, totally naked?
No, it was like the devil... Peter O'Toole, like at the camera.
He's looking at the camera. It's a devil, and it's very
But I watched it again, and it just
didn't hold up
to me. I might go back again because I think my expectations were so high; they were going to come down, and then maybe now I can recalibrate and maybe check it out again because it's still. I mean, you know, it's considered one of those cult classics.
Well, we find
that happened with Dick Tracy.
Yeah, Dick Tracy. I saw Dick Tracy in the theater twice. Loved it. Saw it growing up, you know, memorized it as a, you know.
Really?
And then hadn't seen it in 20 years. And I went back to, I was doing some writing in the era, so I went back to watch movies of that style. And I watched Dick Tracy, and it was like, I couldn't even get through it. And then that was 3 or 4 years ago. And then we watched it for the podcast. And I was like, this is actually, I think a lot has to do of what your frame of mind is at the time. And also with a lot of these, that's something else we try to do. We try to tell, because people, you know, if you watch a movie and people are going to say this is horrible, and I think that's the reason why a lot of people now will crap on a movie, say, "Oh, this is horrible," and we try to.
Who are these people?
You know, like
there are other podcasts.
Who name names?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not gonna.
I'm just joking with you.
No. But there's,
I may want them on the show.
I think it's like, you know, it's kind of like the. That's the style of comedy now, to kind of be like kind of
snarky,
yeah, you know, and satire-y, and certainly with movies we try to give the like we said, the background, yeah. And say like, you know, well, at the time, like,
you're not film critics
nowadays are a lot
anyway.
Different
you're not,
than they
you're
were back then.
Yeah, I mean, this is a show, again, it's called Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, plural. This is not a show about film criticism in the least bit. It's about a nostalgic love of movies. Now, yes, I know you, as you described, you get into the nitty-gritty, into the background, the making of, and all these details, but the genesis of the movies you're choosing are not quality-driven, you know, in a critical context. They are movies that you have a nostalgic connection to or some other kind of emotional connection. I don't know about the Peter Lorre movie, but mostly.
Oh, we love Peter Lorre.
Right. Yeah. You despise me, don't you, Rick?
You hate me, don't you, Rick?
I would if I gave you a thought. But my point is that I think what happens when I, for instance, when I saw The Stuntman again, is that you're watching it again. Your experience is one of nostalgia and your current self. Like, because your concept or memory is of your old, less evolved self watching whatever movie, maybe Dick Tracy, maybe The Stuntman, what have you. And now you've got you now, which is a more maybe developed person. You know, two people basically, and they're butting up, and so that's why you have a different response to it, because you're expecting to have the response you had 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now you go back a third time and you recalibrate, and now you can come to it with a kind of a different perspective. So I think that's why you can watch Dick Tracy, let's say, again for the show, and then, you know, kind of now, okay, I've had that, and my expectations are no longer part of what I'm
It's especially dealing. Tough if you haven't seen the movie in 20 or 30 years.
I would say for me personally, when we do the show, it's about tapping into both of those people, the kid that had wonder for it.
Yes.
And the guy who might be disappointed by it now, and kind of finding a balance that is,
right.
When you talk about it, to be like, all right, this isn't necessarily... Some depends on the movie, you know. This isn't like when we did No Holds Barred again. Like that movie, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. So it's like we try to stay positive, but you know we won't shy away and be like, oh, this movie's amazing if it's not amazing. But it's about like finding, like when we saw it, this was like amazing. Now maybe this doesn't hold up, but this still kind of holds up. It's about finding the balance between like. The jaded adult and like the wondrous child.
And I guess a sort of explanation that like how cinema has changed, where it's so interesting to watch a movie from the 70s or 80s and how different the plotting or even like the timing or just how they lay out the format is completely different from now, where everything's like very, very quick, where you nowadays in the old days, everything's a lot slower.
Are you talking about how
like pacing and you know versus like now?
Oh yes.
Older movies versus
cuts,
now.
For instance,
you know, yeah.
You're both from film school. You met. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you both met at film school.
Day one, we were freshman year. We were roomed together in the same room. We're like, oh hey, and that's when he, you know, he's like, oh Dion, and then oh that was before we started recording. Never mind about us.
But
wait.
So being roommates, there were many.
You were roommates
Saturday
at college?
Sleepover.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha.
There are many movie sleepovers because we
Where
shared
was this?
A room. SUNY Purchase.
Oh, okay. At Purchase, which is known for its arts program.
Yeah. It was the only conservatory, film conservatory at the time when we went.
Yeah, undergraduate.
Yeah.
It was, at the time, it was probably the best undergraduate film program, at least on the East Coast.
Yeah. No, yeah. I know.
It was the doppelganger to NYU. It was like the poor man's NYU. You know, which was fun because freshman year they were giving you equipment to go shoot.
Yeah.
They give you a Bolex 16mm, you know, go make a film. And then, you know, every year we'd make a film by the end of the year. Then we were shooting sound. And by senior year we're shooting, you know, we're using SAG actors and stuff.
We were right on the line there where we were still shooting, like, actual film.
And developing.
And cutting on a flatbed and stuff.
Linearly.
And by the time we were seniors and we were about to graduate, it was kind of making that shift to digital and Avid editing and stuff.
Yeah, well, now it's we talk to the professors now there, and they're saying everything is, you know, everybody shoots it digital.
Yes,
they can show you a cut of their movie on their laptop, where in the old days we'd have to go into like a smoke-filled room with our Steenbecks or Moviolas, and we're there showing them, you know, okay, what do you think of this? You know, it's, you know, now it's completely changed, and that's kind of a lost art. you know, for people in the film, you know, in the film industry.
Well, I got a couple of emails from Kodak, from a publicist who works for Kodak, and they've got some programs for young filmmakers and things of that.
Oh, that's nice.
They're still, yes, it's niche, but they're still fighting the good fight.
Good for them. And they're trying to reinvent themselves and be more out there.
Well, they're better. They almost put themselves.
It was expensive. I mean, we were the money we were dropping at the time on, you know, getting, and we got a discount from Kodak, which was nice. And then we'd have all the developing fees as well. And then after that, just having it all, you know, worked out right, and it was just. You know, you drop a lot of money for college on that, you know. But it was for the love of film. You know, we had a great time there, you know. And we learned a lot.
Exactly.
And then we went into, you know, I mean,
I think there are certain skills that you learn from shooting film that you don't get from video, like economy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can, it doesn't cost you anything. Well, you shoot
editing
a million times.
Well, you have to edit as you go, in a sense. Yeah, you don't, you know, you have to think very economically.
And then all the other, like, little, you know, about sound and, you know, later on, I guess, you know, syncing or even just light exposure, you know, it's all, you don't have to worry about that so much as in the old
lighting
days. You check your, you know, your light meter reading and all that. It was all very much. Mm-hmm. And then we were using cameras that were from, like, you know, the Bolexes were, like, used in the 40s or CP16s, which were, like, you know, people, television cameramen were using them in the late 60s. It's fun, you know, so it was all older equipment, which was nice.
So you stayed in touch all those years, or
we were in school for 4 years together,
And we lived there. I mean, we were in the on the East Coast here, and we moved to the New York area, and we roomed with each other in the early odds, 2005 or six, and then I stayed in the area in Lower Westchester. Blake moved into the city, and then you know, we both work in the city, so we'd see each other.
Right.
You know?
So I mean, we've kind of always been in touch, and I think a lot of the idea of the sleepover comes from, one, when we lived together, but two, like, when we had graduated and we weren't living together or we didn't see each other all the time. Like, there was a period there where Dion was, like, living in his parents' basement, you know, saving money to then, you know, go on and do what he does now. But, like, I would come up and we would
sleepover, you know, get a case of beer or whatever, and we'd have a weekend and we'd watch as many movies.
And we would end up watching
movies.
Marathons.
Yeah, yeah, of whatever.
So when did you guys decide to do a podcast? Like, when was that, and how did that...
It was a couple years ago. I had been doing a podcast for a little while.
You were?
Yeah, a site called Podwits. And then I was noticing other people doing, like, comic book podcasts where people were analyzing.
Really?
Psychoanalyzing. They would take Spider-Man, and they'd go through issue one and go, and each podcast would be an episode. And I was like, that's fascinating that they would go through. And then people wanted that. So I said to Blake, I said, why don't we just do that for movies? We'll just do a movie podcast.
Well, we talked about it. And I was like, well...
You're like, who's going to want to listen to us?
Well, I was... One, it was like, well, how do you, you know, start with, like, you know, Amazing Fantasy number 16 or 15 or whatever, and then, you know, who would want to listen to... What could you do where it'd be like you would tackle every issue? And I was like, well, we could do a TV series, but I was like, I don't know if I want to get roped into talking about, you know, like, MacGyver for... You know, years straight.
And full disclosure, I'm a huge MacGyver fan.
That's
why he brought that up.
Yeah.
And so
but again, you could just do the MacGyver movie and get it over with real fast.
Yeah. Now, that is best example.
But I was afraid of, like, if we start with episode one, we would then feel obligated to stick with a certain topic.
The Fall Guy for 4 seasons.
So we kind of talked about it.
Better than $6 million Man.
Yeah.
So we talked about it, and we kind of came to agreement. Well, like, let's do something that we know that can change. Like, we can do a horror movie 1 week, and then we can do an action movie the next week. And
or even we've delved into television movies
or whatever. Or, you know, it was like less. You know, there wasn't as many restrictions as, like, you know, committing to, like, something very specific. But here it's like we can kind of commit to something specific, in that it's a type of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but we can have the fun of just jumping around.
Yeah, and it's a platform for us. We can use it as a MacGuffin to, like, we can basically just throw any movie in, you know, to a certain extent, which is fun, as opposed to we're pigeonholing ourselves, say, like, with just we pick a TV show or whatever, and then we're kind of stuck, and it's like, oh, we gotta go, you know, we're committed to that, we gotta finish it out, as opposed to we can now jump around.
Some of the movies don't fit necessarily. Like, we did Rocky, and I wouldn't say Rocky necessarily is, like, the kind of sleepover movie that the rest of the movies kind of seem like. But it was a movie that's really important to me.
Yeah.
And so...
But it also, for people, it could have been a sleepover movie. You know, people could have rented Rocky. You know, it's like action, any kind of movie. Any kind of movie. It depends on who you are, what you define, I guess, as a sleepover movie. And then this is a good podcast where we can just use that as a jumping off point to just go do, like, Mad Love. You know, where it's like, well, you know, we don't know who's going to download this, but at the same time, people should know and love who Peter Lorre was and what they accomplished back then. And we tried to educate people.
That, and we love that movie, Peter Lorre.
So and that whole era as well. You know,
you adore me, don't you?
My name is Joe Cairo. Please put your hands up. Yeah, so we love that era. We love older films as well. It's not just 80s and 90s, so we'd like to you know, and school other people to that
as well. Of course, of course. What's the current episode?
As of this recording, we Smokey and the Bandit dropped, and then we have Never Ending Story coming out this week of this recording. Yeah, that's kind of our pseudo 50th episode.
Oh,
you know
what's pseudo about it?
Because
we do other side. We're not exactly podcasts, as you call them, right?
Yeah, we do sidecasts. We recycle.
Is that your own thing, or did somebody else make that up?
That was from my older podcast at Podwitz. I would do these. That's when I first brought Blake on board. Hey, let's do something together, and he's like, well, what are we going to do? So we started talking general topics, movie mostly related, some were music. So we do these things called the sidecast, which is kind of like a side venture on that podcast I did there. Right. And then we started recirculating them on our site, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, and then we started doing some new ones. We did an interview with Randy Jurgensen, who's a famed New York City police detective.
I did listen to that. That was
actor from the 70s,
of course.
Connected to William Friedkin, and Blake did another one with a contributor, Dave Hastings, on Silver Bullet. So, and then we said, hey, you know, we'll start doing these again, and they're not just us picking a movie and talking about a movie for God knows how long. It's us we can generalize about a genre or whatever. And then that's the reason why we're pseudo 50, because we've dropped a couple of those.
I see. Very good.
So
do you have a favorite? I think it sounds like maybe the Batman was that one
for,
of
it's our most popular.
Tim Burton's Batman.
Favorite we've done. I don't know what I would think of favorite. I mean, we have some fun ones. I don't know.
For me, I can't say I had a favorite episode because, I'm dealing with human beings that are coming on.
But you sometimes were probably, you'll have an interview that'll go really well, and then you'll have one that might not go well. And
For sure.
Like there's a cohesion or like there's a chemistry where you're like, that was great because. Yeah.
Well, William Friedkin was on, and he was awful. I can't stand that son of a bitch. So maybe I shouldn't say that out loud.
He's slapping you to tell you to work harder.
Start firing off guns to get reactions.
Yeah, throw you down a flight of stairs.
Alex is shaking his head. No, we love William Friedkin. And he is probably one of the best guests you'll ever want because he gives so much.
He's amazing. Yeah, I've seen him.
I got to get him back on because... Yeah. He's William Friedkin for one thing.
Yeah, and he just one of my favorite.
He directed The Exorcist, for God's sake.
Yeah, one of my favorite movies is his Sorcerer. That's just
The Sorcerer. I know.
Just come out, and he was circulating that around.
Yes.
I saw him.
Did you read his
that.
Book too?
No, I read the bits about Sorcerer, and then I met him. He did a screening at BAM, and he was lovely.
Yeah, I was there too.
Randy, were you there for that?
Yeah, I was there.
And
I was
for the Sorcerer screening.
Yes. Well, you can find Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers podcast on certainly on the iTunes.
Yeah.
But you can also find it on Stitcher. Where else?
Yeah, we're Stitcher, Player FM, all the podcast aggregates. We're on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers.
Yeah, we have a pretty fun Facebook community.
What's that?
Our Facebook community is kind of fun.
Oh, that's good.
We post a lot.
Facebook.com/
Saturday Night Movie Sleepover. Saturday. Yeah.
Okay. Something like that.
Yeah, so you type it in, you'll find it.
If you type it in, it'll come up.
We're on Twitter. We're at Sat Sleepovers. Okay. And we have our website.
What's the website?
SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. But if you just Google Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, you'll find us. It'll come right up.
Right.
And, I think, we're on basically any podcast
Most
aggregate.
Most of them, Like Overcast, Stitcher, all those.
Yeah,
and Blake has a book coming out as well.
Oh, right.
Very soon.
Yeah.
I have a book called Scored to Death, Conversations with Some of Horror's Greatest Composers.
That's fantastic.
And it comes out in early summer.
Yeah, and he also...
2016.
So you can come back on and talk about that.
I would love to.
Yeah, and you have a Facebook page for that, too.
Everything Scored to Death. Facebook, to death. Twitter. Just look it up.
It's too early to pre-order.
Too early to pre-order. But we're getting
there.
Let
me know so we can help.
But he's done some pretty well interviews there. Fair play to him, as they say.
Some composers talking about what they do. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
You talk to people about what they do all the time.
That's true. No, and I talk about, and I don't have enough composers on. I know a few, but, mostly composed for, indie films, of course.
Larry Fessenden, who you've had on, wrote a foreword for it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Larry is a great guy.
What's Larry done? So for the people out there who might not know Larry.
Well, he runs Glass Eye Picks.
Out of Brooklyn.
And
he's an actor,
Habit,
producer.
And,
Habit. Have you seen Habit?
Winter,
no, I haven't. Go check that out.
I think I've seen Last Winter, yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I interviewed Jeff Grace, who works a lot with Glass Eye Picks.
Right.
And Ty West's movies.
Yeah, he's executive producers or produces a lot of horror films.
Ty West.
But not just horror films. He also produces for Kelly Reichardt.
Oh, okay.
Wendy and Lucy, Night Moves. Not the original.
Well, thank you, guys. This has
been
fantastic.
Thank you for cutting out some time for us.
No, it's been. I'm sorry it took so long, but I'm really thrilled that you guys came on, and I'm glad for people that many more people to know about your podcast.
Well,
you put a lot of work into it, and it's definitely a film lover's show.
You're nostalgic about movies.
What's coming up? Did I ask that already? What's coming up?
Yeah,
you said
Smokey
and the Bandit's currently
is out, and then, end of this week is Neverending Story.
Oh, right, Neverending Story.
And then a preview, I guess, for a couple weeks. We have a side cast coming out, which we reminisce about Blake's trip to L.A., where he met some people and stuff. And then I think the next one we have is Commando. We're going to bust.
We got a big summer coming up.
Yeah,
summer
1985's Schwarzenegger's amazingly awful.
Yeah,
Commando.
I was thinking of what's his name, the tall Danish guy, the
Dolph Lundgren.
Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, Red Scorpion, maybe.
Maybe I'm confusing my side on how that's possible.
We're kicking open the door of summer of 16 with a real 80s action extravaganza.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you, everybody, for listening. Appreciate it very much. Those latter two segments, by the way, were both recorded at the Showbriz Studios in the East Village of New York. And, you know, Showbriz, what is that? Well, it's a play on words. It's Alex Brizell, and it's showbiz, right? So there you go, if you hadn't figured that out. It's going to be a great, as I said, I think a boon to the show. If you want to check out the other podcasts, I would recommend, I've been listening to them. There is one fellow who does a podcast, Mark Malkoff. He's a really remarkable guy. I think he's out of L.A. He must be, because he does the podcast just about the Johnny Carson show. It's called the Carson Podcast. And each week he brings on, or each episode he brings on, somebody else who has some sort of relationship with Carson or The Tonight Show and interviews them at length. They're great. A lot of fun. I just listened to a couple, one with Paul Anka, one with Pat Boone, one with Pat Sajak. It's a lot of fun to listen to. Another one is the Canon Films Project, which likewise just obsesses over a singular thing. This is the Golan Globus company, the Canon Films, all these low-budget films that these Israeli producers put out back in the, I think mostly in the 70s into the 80s. And this podcast just disseminates each film one by one in each episode. I don't know what they're going to do when they finally run out. Maybe they'll start over. There's a podcast called Spent, which is the first funny money podcast for the financially challenged, hosted by stand-up comic Lindsay Goldwert. So there's that one. Then there's the movie preview review with Kevin Bartini, where Kevin and various guests of his listen to trailers of upcoming films and riff. And then David Feldman, a comedy writer. I guess he's best known for writing for Jon Stewart's show. Most recently, anyway, he's got his own podcast. Again, he brings on different comedians and filmmakers and types of people like that and talks to them at length. And again, highly recommended. And then my friend Scott Rogowski, you may recall, he is was on a couple of times on the show. Or a few times, I should say. And he's a stand-up comic, and he has a late-night talk show that he does live. He did one recently at Union Hall in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And I assume he's going to be doing a bunch of others there as well. And then the shows are podcasted. And again, that's one is called Running Late with Scott Rogowski. That's part of the network. And then my show, Film Wax Radio. So go check out any of these podcasts. Thank you to everybody for continuing to listen to the show. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name is Film Wax Radio. Until next time, take care.
high.